Paul Rodel one more time. And today is July 20th. It's Saturday. And 20th, yeah. And I'm in the home of both Alan and Bunheng Inverson. I guess actually it's Riverside, even though you're kind of, yeah.
Riverdale, Maryland.
Okay. In Riverdale, Maryland. And as you can undoubtedly hear, we're listening to birds in the backyard and avoiding the inside. Anyway, Al was in Laos from 1969 until finally IVS evacuated in May. May 25th, I was reminded, of 1975. So, many stories to tell. Don't worry, I brought tape. And
I remember them all.
Yeah, and you remember them all.
Maybe.
We'll see. But I'll start off with the standard question about the individual background, when and where born, parents, who they were, and actually you were kind of talking about that before, and how they brought you up and the influences on your life that brought you eventually to the door of IVS. And now I will just sit back
and relax. And,
yes.
You work now.
Yeah.
I was born in New York City, Lenox City Hospital, Lenox Hill Hospital or something, in 44, hard to remember, and lived the first six years in Forest Hills in the city. And then we finally moved out to the suburbs, which is near White Plains, Scarsdale, up just north of New York City. Parents were both Swiss. As I mentioned before, they came over and met each other here. My father worked at the Swiss Bank Corporation in downtown Wall Street, and my mother was a mother, primarily.
But came over here in kind of interesting circumstances, I found.
She wanted to see the world for some reason, and trained as a governess. And then went back and worked with a number of people in New York as a governess. I was raised, since my parents were both Swiss and met here, had recently come over here where they met and got married. They spoke French at home pretty much all the time. And so we spoke French all the time at home, and didn't realize until I entered school, kindergarten in Forest Hills, that one doesn't speak French in school, that one speaks English. And so one had to change a little bit. I don't remember much of a couple of traumatic experiences. I mean, experiences of getting lost and not being able to find my way around in class, getting caught up in the second grade as opposed to kindergarten and being with the big kids or something like that. A few instances. But we spoke French also, I guess, unlike many of the kids in my age. We went to Europe almost, every 5 years we went to Europe, which is very unusual in those days. My father worked with a Swiss bank, and I believe they paid for the trip every 5 years. And then we used to go 1 year in between. So every two or three years we used to go to Europe, from ever since 47, 46, on up through high school. Often went on freighters, because my father worked in the bank, knew we shipping owners, and arranged for trips, free trips essentially, across the Atlantic, ending up somewhere. We never knew where we were ending up, because freighters were like that. You sort of jumped on a freighter and they ended up going in Europe or back to America, but not really sure where they would end up very often, because they changed their schedules from time to time. So sometimes we ended up from Rotterdam and ended up in Northern Baltic, inside the Arctic Circle, and then before going back to Baltimore or New York or Montreal or wherever. Anyway, but I guess the point is we travel quite a bit, unlike most people.
Well, my parents only went to Michigan to see relatives.
Yeah. Well, see, my parents, all the relatives were in Switzerland, essentially.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
So we went there for that reason and traveled quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I entered MIT, I went on my own then with friends and then started going out further afield than Switzerland and France, but going to Greece, for example, branching out a little further.
That was rare for college students to do that too.
No, it was in the 60s, it was already, there were already students doing that.
Okay.
It was more, and I went one summer, I went for a course, you know, a German course in Salzburg for a few weeks. It was full of Americans there, all doing the same thing, all learning German in theory, but all speaking English. It wasn't the best place to go. Basically, that's the beginning. Parents were European. They were also Calvinists, Lutherans by upbringing. So they were very careful with their money. So we were one of the last families to have a TV, and we never had a bicycle until we got the final bike, namely the English, you know, the adult bike.
Oh.
So we wouldn't have to spend money to buy little bikes and bigger bikes and bigger bikes. We got the big bike at the end. So we had a very adequate. We traveled a lot. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any of the luxuries at home. It was a simple, fairly simple lifestyle. See what else. That's really it for my early upbringing, I guess. I mean, I did many more things, but did very well in school. The third, I guess, generally in second or third in class. And
this is what, high school?
In high school.
Yeah.
And it was more of a scholarly type, I guess, than others. My brother, on the other hand, was not, and he had to compete with me and did very poorly, so there was always this business of
yes,
the good son and the less good son,
however
it was perceived, and more problematical son, the other one, whereas I was tended to be what they expected of a son, I guess.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway.
I think all of us know sibling rivalry at one sort or another. Either on the giving or the receiving end. Usually it's a combination.
Yeah. And I did pretty well in sciences, and therefore when it was time to go to college, I chose a few schools, the traditional good technical schools, Caltech and MIT and Carnegie, and was accepted probably by all of them, I can't remember, but MIT was one of them, so I ended up going to MIT. Didn't know very much about college, because my parents didn't know much about college, so I, you know, it was very strange to me. I was sort of sheltered from that point of view. I didn't really know much about the American way, I guess. You know, graduate, undergraduate, what's the difference? I mean, what is graduate? You know, am I a graduate when I graduate from high school? Or, I mean, just these terms were, didn't
because you just graduated from high school, so now you're an undergraduate again.
It just didn't seem. But everyone was happy that I did go to MIT because of the name and everything else. So the family was happy. And went to MIT, did the usual thing. It was probably hard in the beginning because everyone had 800s on their boards, and I had 700 something, and therefore, you know, I was the poorer of the students, it seemed like. But if you just stick at it, it was very difficult in the beginning. If you just stick at it, you memorize the system, you learn the system, not memorize, you learn the system, and you master technique, and you learn how to study, et cetera. And I guess it was at that time, it was interesting because when I first entered MIT, I was sort of...
this would have been what, like 64, 63?
62,
okay.
When I first entered MIT, I was eager already to go overseas to do something good, whatever.
Really?
And then, I was thinking of the special forces, something exciting.
Oh.
So it was interesting because I actually asked for literature on armed forces, etc. And as a freshman, I also, which was very strange in a way, well, maybe not, you're coming from European family after the war, the idea of America being a great country and the armed forces supporting this noble cause and all
right.
It seemed like.
Mm-hmm.
So I befriended a Cuban, who mm-hmm. was a rich Cuban, apparently, who was anti-Castro, apparently, and he started his own student committee for the freedom of Cuba or something like that. And I help him out, handing out brochures occasionally, which is very on the right side. It was interesting. I start off kind of on the right side.
Uh-huh.
I mean, right as opposed to the left, or more the militant, not really militant, but more the right.
Yeah, this is kind of an anti-Castro kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also then as the year progressed, it was also the Vietnam War days, and Boston was a hotbed of activity on
sure.
all sides.
Yeah.
And I ended up going to a number of...
there's one.
VNs, love-ins, teach-ins, all, the whole hippie day
yeah.
thing.
Uh-huh.
Especially the teach-ins at Boston University, my first teach-in, if you're familiar with those teach-ins,
mm-hmm.
where they had invited people from the entire spectrum, pro-war, anti-war, and they just spent virtually all night,
yeah.
Having presentations, speeches, etc., discussions about various aspects. That's when I became much more aware of the issues, and through that period, through the mid-60s, because there's a lot on TV. And a lot happening in Vietnam. And then I started questioning more and more the American policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so much so that towards the end, I also had some friends in the church who were conscientious objectors, a few of them, who were not trying to promote their ideas, but who just, that was their ideas.
This was what, Lutheran church?
No, by that time, my mother was looking around for something more meaningful, and she ended up finding Christian Science, and so I became a Christian Scientist and went to that church while I was in Boston, because that's the headquarters of the church also,
mm-hmm.
And applied as an objector, conscious objector, and it was an interesting period probing into that idea of conscientious objection and war and resolving issues by force.
But Christian Scientists, they're not an automatic category.
No, they're not a peace, quote, peace.
Yeah,
church.
Right.
No, they're not. Actually, there are a number of people who are very much on the other side.
Uh-huh.
That was part of the growing up experience, because we had meetings and with some other people from the church there. We had every 2 years a biennial meeting, it was called, where students from all around the world would come to the church, and we would have a 3-4 day meeting about issues.
Mm-hmm.
And at one of those meetings, we got together and put out a brochure on conscientious objection, providing it as an alternative,
mm-hmm.
making people aware of what it meant.
Yeah.
But it was really a minority view, generally.
Oh, sure. I'm sure that it always has been.
Yeah. So, but it was, anyway, I applied May of my, I went 4 years undergraduate in aerospace engineering, and then continued in a master's program automatically, an engineer's program. It was engineer's degree, and master's degree as an add-on for another 2 years. And
mm-hmm.
it was at the end of those 2 years that I applied, in May, I think it was, I applied as an objector, just before graduation of my master's degree. So it was
very much towards the end. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it was very much towards the end. I remember the year or two before graduating, I actually went to apply for AID. I said, this military stuff, I'm not too sure about, but AID seems like an interesting organization, USAID.
USAID.
And they were in downtown Boston recruiting.
Oh, okay.
For Vietnam.
Okay.
So I was interested in going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied. And we went through a language test and everything else, and I didn't make it for one reason or another.
A language test for
yeah.
AID?
Yeah, there was. There was a interesting language test. It was some Middle East language they use as a testing language, and it was an interesting little test.
Yeah. I can't see why, considering the number of people that I know in AIE who don't know a word of any place where they live.
That's true. It wasn't Vietnam. I'm not sure whether there was an acknowledgement that you had to speak Vietnamese to get something done or not. But that was part of the test.
Yeah. It was part of the test. Okay.
So, so I got in, I was thinking about that also.
Thinking about
going overseas.
Oh, okay.
At that time, and I applied as an objector towards the end of my a month or so before graduation, and then applied for Peace Corps.
Yeah,
because I wanted to go overseas. Trained for Peace Corps, but of course I had didn't have any deferment by that time. The draft board was out to get me because
For Peace Corps.
I trained in Lexington for as a small business consultant in India. I mean, those were the days where if you were white, you could do anything.
Yeah.
And
right?
I had questions about what I would do in business to become a businessman. But we figured if you spend two months in Lexington, University of Kentucky in Lexington, in Appalachia, which is also small businesses in that area, that you could learn about the ratios and do various little. You know business.
Yeah.
And you were white, and therefore you could just walk into a shop in India and be able, into a little factory, and be able to find out how to improve their operation. It was just the way.
Yeah. The way people assumed. You yourself were the magic bullet.
That's right. Except I passed and learned Marathi, and then didn't get deferment from the draft board, so the Peace Corps didn't want to take any chances, so they, at that point, they said, we'll see, stay here, and we'll see what happens to you. Well, what happens?
Stay here in Lexington.
In the States.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I went back to Boston, since I'd been there 6 years, and got work in the warehouse, the monitor, science monitor warehouse. Oh. While waiting to, I got an induction notice. I applied. I appealed to the state board, and it took time, so I went back to Boston to wait that out. Those kinds of things.
Yeah. And dragging them out as long as possible.
And then finally, induction notice coming, but I was not in New York. I was in Boston, so you transferred to Boston, and people in Boston were very generous, and they said, okay, we'll delay it another month until the next go-around, that kind of thing. Meanwhile, I was eager to go to Vietnam because it was an interesting place, clearly, the war and everything else, but I didn't want to go in the military capacity anymore.
Uh-huh.
And so I applied for various peace churches. Brethren was one group, not necessarily in Vietnam, but was working overseas. And IVS was one that was working in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And so I applied to IVS. And
how did you find out about it?
I think it's probably through when I was applying for. As an objector, you get familiarize yourself with who the actors were, who were the traditional conscientious objectors, what organizations were there, and you knew that there was alternative service, and you may as well
start looking. Okay.
And I think
it was your own research.
Yeah.
It wasn't a recruiter coming on campus. It wasn't anybody you met or things like that.
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
It was. I think probably the brethren who mentioned IVS.
Uh huh.
It was one group I had corresponded with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
you contacted them.
Yeah. And they took me in.
Mm-hmm.
There was a slot in Laos, which is pretty close. She appeared interesting.
Of course, there's no war going on there.
That's right. So it was close enough. And so they were willing to take a gamble with me. They realized I didn't have my deferment. Meanwhile, I'd gone to a state appeal. It was rejected unanimously, the state appeal. I appealed anyway to presidential appeal, and it wasn't incumbent on them, but they took it up anyway. Hershey's office, Hershey. And then by the time I worked with a group, National Interreligious Service Board for Religious Injectors or something, NISPRO, a group in Washington that was working with Hershey.
Uh-huh.
And there were several groups working with Hershey, but this was a group that was trying to work within the system, and I guess Hershey
gave credibility to their evaluation of various people who claimed. Whereas other groups were more militantly against the system and less cooperative. So anyway, they were helping me at the same time, this group on New York Avenue.
I can see how he would want to do that. Find a church group that he could work with so that he could say that he's open to that sort of thing.
So anyway, that...
extraneous comment, sorry.
So anyway, they had a position for me as a math teacher. I hadn't had any education classes, but you know, better than business development.
Yeah, no, it's much
it closer.
Much closer to your own strengths.
Physics and math teacher in the teacher training college in English. It was a USAID school. So,
this is where you were going to go.
Yeah, and so in the end, I didn't get my deferment, but I took off anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That was in '69. I graduated in '68, finally from MIT. Spent a year going through the Quakers and others, trying to find out how to get myself recognized as an objector by the board. A very difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an interesting time because it forced you to address some of the issues.
Yes.
Which most people often didn't.
No. I mean, there's usually no reason to address any issues.
So, that's it. 1969, I went to Laos.
Mm-hmm.
Just to finish that chapter is, in December, I get my induction notice.
Uh-huh.
And refused induction by mail through this organization in Washington who stopped my letter. Instead of forwarding it, because my file was still in Washington, it was an illegal action on the part of my local board, which was trying to make believe that I had failed at the presidential appeal level and therefore my time was up.
Yeah.
And shortly thereafter, I got my deferment and got IVS approved as an alternative service employer. Not retroactive, because they weren't going to be nice to me. They were going to make it last. But in the end, I ended up spending 6 years there anyway. So
you did more than enough time.
So that chapter was an interesting chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued. And if you look at my newsletters, there a number of them talk about the war and those issues.
Yeah. I'm sure, I've read some of the newsletters, and they all do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, most of them are not. Gee, the weather is nice today.
Yeah. No, because you became much more aware of it. Less so in my position, because I was a teacher in K9, 9 kilometers north of Yangcheon, and lived on the compound there, on the school compound.
Oh, not at Kilometer 6.
No, not at Kilometer 6. We passed it. We saw it all the time, but we didn't. We were kept our distance from Kilometer 6.
How come?
I kept my distance from aid. I just prefer being in the bush, number one.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in the bush, and I saw no reason really to... I had no reason to go to K6, the American ghetto there. You know, it was just... It was like the American ghetto. I mean, it was really nice ranch-style homes, with nice green lawns, the usual thing, American community. And I was just interested. On the weekends, I would just walk, take a whole day, and just walk out in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
From village to village. It wasn't really legal, but I kept quiet and just did my walking, just to learn the language and see a bit.
So who did you actually live with?
We lived on campus. There were some USAID homes, apartments that were built, two-story apartments.
Okay.
Each apartment had four sets of, each building had four sets of apartments, two on the bottom, two on top.
Okay.
And there were six of these, three and three, at the corner of the campus. Many of the teachers live there. Plus, slowly,
Lao teachers,
IVS teachers initially, but there was more and more Lao teachers started moving in also.
Okay.
And then for one semester, I lived outside in a village nearby with Walt Haney and Steve Bunk, another chemistry teacher.
Mm-hmm.
We lived together in Ban Pakal, which is a couple of kilometers away from school.
Okay.
It was actually on the back road to Kilometer 6, the American ghetto. Halfway there, you get to this village, Ban Pakal.
Mm-hmm. But it certainly was not Kilometer 6.
Oh, no, definitely it was a local village.
So it was only 3 kilometers away, kilometer and a half away, but a light year away, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. It was an interesting experience living out there. It was just for a semester, really, half a year.
Okay.
that was an interesting experience. Then I came back on campus and lived on campus. Mm-hmm. But often walked around, if I could, in the villages on weekends. And then
how come?
I just wanted to get out and mm-hmm. see what there was.
Mm-hmm.
I did most of it on foot. Occasionally, one time I went up to Luang Prabang illegally again. This was all illegal because you couldn't go very far. And if they, like Walt Haney, you know what happened to him.
Yeah.
But he went to kilometer 13, which is just beyond the school, and that disqualified
him. Not very far at all. No. I mean,
and that was enough to
get him bounced.
Yeah, because that was the regulations were kilometer 9 was the limits, and it was dangerous thereafter, and you couldn't go beyond that. So I ended up.
How dangerous was it?
Well, you don't know. It wasn't dangerous in the plains area. And this is all Vientiane Plains, which goes for 30 kilometers, depending on what direction you go, 40 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably wasn't. Clearly wasn't any bombing. May have been visitors from the Pathet Lao coming down occasionally, but it wasn't well-traveled. I guess that's why it was seen as dangerous. You know, it wasn't a well-traveled route, and therefore we keep to the cities. Plus, IVS volunteers had recently been assassinated, so they weren't apt to go out to test the limits.
Okay, but yeah.
But there wasn't really much in the plains itself that I know of. I mean, in terms of when we traveled officially
mm-hmm.
In the Vientiane Plain later as part of the program, visiting students in the summer work program, and there was no... there was no problems. We used the clearance. On the other hand, if you go... When I did go and hitchhike up to the Luang Prabang, it's a major trip, and it took a couple of days to get up there by truck, and that was illegal. And you do come across areas which even today have been, until recently anyway, may still be somewhat risky because there are bandits still there, left over from the...
Okay.
And it was always a risky area to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I ended up going to Luang Prabang, and of course when you're in Luang Prabang, you can't say, I want to train an Air America flight back, because they would have said, what are you doing here? How did you get here? And that would have been sufficient to let you...
They would have done a Walt Haney on you.
So I had to find my truck back again.
Yeah.
My truck back. And I slept that night on the back of cinnamon bark. I remember that because it was really hard. And came back and arrived back. It was all
smelled
night.
Good, I bet.
Well, it was, you know, dry on the outside, so it wasn't...
Oh, okay.
Break it up. So anyway, I preferred staying out and mixing with people there. I went to the morning market occasionally, because I enjoyed mm-hmm. that once a week. We used to go to the morning market and just chat with the ladies, the merchants there. And just,
yeah.
But I didn't go to the pool very much, the swimming pool at the commissary in town. I did go to the commissary occasionally
mm-hmm.
to get the essentials. But I often ate at the restaurant at school.
Yeah.
So that wasn't too much, and I didn't go very often to the movies, the American movies there. I just didn't see much purpose to going there. So I tended to go out.
Because that was an issue at one point.
It was, yeah, among some people. Mm-hmm. Some people, some IVSers spend their weekends in the poolside eating hamburgers and stuff. And others refused to go, and others were sort of one way or the other. It didn't make much difference to them.
Where would you put yourself? I mean, obviously not hanging out poolside.
No, and not I was still going there, making use of their facilities occasionally,
uh-huh,
but
uh-huh.
More on the side of not making use of their facilities than making use of their facilities.
Okay.
More on that side.
Because I've talked to John Dunlop.
Yeah, and John would have, and there were others who enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And I just preferred walking in the bush.
Yeah.
You know, my sandals and go in the bush. Just push
By bush, you just mean going from village to village.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what I assumed. But the folks who'd been killed, were they killed before you arrived?
Yeah, they were, and that was a big thing. We had our usual meeting at the Harpers Ferry before the teams leave. We always met in Harpers Ferry for a couple of days. The big issue was that there were a number of people who had been assassinated. Are you still interested in going? We're changing our operating style. We're not going into the countryside anymore. We're tightening ourselves. We're getting more into education, more urban-based activities.
Yeah.
Are you still interested or not?
So, uh-huh.
you know, So we were told that what had happened, mm-hmm. was really up to us to go, and you know, what assassinations didn't mean very much. I mean, they weren't really real.
Yeah.
You hear about it. There were people out in the bush. They were driving the jeeps at night or whatever. You know, we weren't going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So
you figured it was not really too relevant to your own situation.
Right.
Tragic in an abstract sense.
It was very much abstract.
Yeah.
In that case.
What did they say about how? Let me recap because I would like to know what they were really telling you about the circumstances of the deaths. They were saying that it's because they were far away from towns that they died.
Well, they were far away from towns. I mean,
that's right.
That's the impression I still have. So I assume they were. Maybe they weren't.
Because IVS had been far away from towns for a long time.
It had, yeah. But we were also told, I think it was, and it's hard to tell me to remember exactly where I was told this, but one was also the impression, possibly from IVS,
mm-hmm.
that a number of the earlier IVSs were.
So you were told that the earlier ones were more macho than you.
Yeah, they were. Wow. You know, they were anyway, they were. You know, they were on the frontier.
Yeah.
Frontlands of freedom, and there's little airplanes coming in with ammunition occasionally, with CIA this and that. It was kind of cool kind of atmosphere, if you like that kind of thing. And some of the IVSers had, all of them apparently had walkie-talkies to get in touch with IVS.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that could be interpreted any way you want. Interpreting and who knew what you were relaying, mm-hmm. in terms of information.
And even if you were relaying, everything is clear, that in a sense could be usable information.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it could be. Plus, I think I was told that some of them also had guns or in the field. I'm sure whether IVSers were or, it's sort of very vague at that point. But there was basically a few people were macho, liked that the military kind of atmosphere. And there were some, we were shown some transcripts from PL broadcasts about IVS.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I have no idea what those transcripts are or where we saw them, but there were several transcripts from PL radio. So it was clear that the actions of a few people, the way it was portrayed to us, probably tainted the view of IVS as a front for CIA.
Uh-huh.
Even though many of the IVSers were, IVS, I guess, was started as an conscientious alternative service for conscientious objectors. So many people were anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
You
were talking originally or during your time, too?
Well, originally, but also it led into our mm-hmm. time. Although there were fewer, there were more generalists, if you want.
Generalists?
As opposed to not people who are COs, but just ordinary
Peace Corps type folks who wanted to do
a
service.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. But I think just the fact that there were a few people that were seemed to be have this kind of macho air about them and radios and guns and helping out a little bit, and it was hard to it could easily be portrayed as working with the CIA as a friend of CIA,
mm-hmm.
and this came sort of clear to me when I was in Peace Corps training because we had role playing.
Oh, uh-huh.
And there was one case where there was a Peace Corps volunteer sitting next to another guy who was role-playing, and he was playing the role of an Indian.
Okay.
And a Peace Corps volunteer was playing the role of a Peace Corps volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
Typical good guy, true blue American. The Indian, they would ask him questions about the camera he had, about his training, about his, his interests and whatever. And at the end, the Indian...
Just like I'm doing now.
Yeah, the Indian said, there's a lot of rumors around India that you guys in Peace Corps are fronts for the CIA. But after meeting with you and talking with you, I'm convinced. And you're, what? What do you mean? This Peace Corps volunteer did such a good job and being so friendly and nice and personable to this Indian and telling him what he wanted and you know, sort of exchanging ideas very freely, really portraying the idea of a good American.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly the Indian says, I'm convinced now, you're CIA.
Uh-huh.
And then he proceeded to give indicators of why he felt the guy was CIA, why he was convinced he was CIA. And, you know, his technical training was one of them, I remember. The other one was the camera, the expensive camera he had around his neck. And, you know, you can interpret things any way you want. And the same thing with, potentially, with Peace Corps in Laos. Mm-hmm. These guys...
Or you mean IVS?
IVS in Laos. Yeah, yeah, these guys were in the field, and you, whatever actions they did could be interpreted anyway.
Yeah.
No, and so it could be, you know, it seemed like it made sense that the PL saw them as a front for the CIA because of some of the actions of a few people, and some were killed as a result, assassinated as a result of that. Although, you know, I'm not sure who carried out the assassinations and whether it was really just local people or a concerted effort on part of the hierarchy of the Patalao or not.
That's the kind of stuff that will probably never be known for sure.
Yeah, so... But basically, we knew there were assassinations. We knew there was in the field. We knew we were retracting, getting closer to the urban areas. And then I would be teaching it essentially just outside town.
Right.
On the plains, which is a very flat area, which is very open and
defendable.
Yeah. And there's no problems there in that part of the country. So it didn't really, and most of us, I think all of us went in that team because... there was an assassination, but it was several, but it didn't mean much to us. Plus, it was in the countryside.
Uh-huh.
So there was those two factors both didn't discourage us from, discourage us from going.
Mm.
And
I'm sure there are plenty of people getting into airplanes today.
Yeah, right. Right. And after...
I should say for the tape, despite the fact that it was only a couple of days ago, the TWA Flight 800 blew up.
That's right.
You know.
Unknown circumstances.
Yeah.
But we also, even after the first year, I ended up working in a student summer work program where we provided experiences for high school kids, secondary school kids, in development activities, often employed by aid for a couple of weeks, for a couple of months, and giving them a nominal couple of dollars, $3 a week, I think I just read in my newsletter. So it was really a nominal fee, and they would teach and whatnot. And with them, I ended up going a couple of times to visit students who were near Longcheng, near the in the area where north of the Nam Ngum Dam, northeast of the Nam Ngum Dam area, Plain of Jars, in that direction. And when we flew in helicopters to visit our students, I did it once only. It was a war zone. You could fly over a strip, and it was a dirt strip on the side of a mountain, and the pilot would fly several times until a certain number of flags were laid out on the ground, and there was a certain code that meant it was all clear. So it was clearly a dangerous area. Plus, they didn't stay there. We stayed there, and they would fly off, and they'd come back an hour later after we did our thing. But it never hit home, really. That's one thing, I guess, in Laos. The war really never hit home. You'd occasionally hear bombing way out in the distance. You see... occasionally planes going overhead. Once I saw, I was coming, going up, flying up to Luang Prabang, which was on Royal Air Lao, on a very plush, a small airplane, but very plush, and piped in music. It was a very nice plane. The pilot would interrupted the music and said, if you look out the window, there are some tankers fueling some fighters going up a second trip up north. They went up once, dropped some bombs, came back, halfway back, got reloaded, refueled, and went back. And this was just outside your wingtip, so the war was just there, and yet, you know, the pipe and music and everything else is surrealistic.
That is surreal. Yeah. It really
and
is.
Then the way down from the Luang Prabang, once I saw, just out of the point of the wing, a bombing run just north of the Nam Ngum Dam. There was a black cloud, and it was a little T-28 pilot, single prop fighters that the Army used to have, the local
you
Army.
You mean the T-28, the
Lala, yeah. But it was, generally, it was very... That was bad. It was we were far from the war from that point of view. That was bad because
you're talking 69.
All 69 through 75.
Really through 75.
Yeah, you really didn't know there was a war. I mean, there was soldiers around here and there, but it wasn't. Vientiane was. There was no war. I mean, you didn't see the war.
Yeah.
We went up to Ban Hui Sai up north once, and we saw a few helicopters piloted by Americans, and they gave us the finger because when we were looking at them, because we were at the airport, they didn't like what we were doing, that we were there, etc. They were kind of,
why?
It was because they weren't there, the Americans.
Yeah.
And they were just sort of, I guess we had our cameras and we were taking pictures, and they were a little upset or something.
Was the secret war already exposed by that time?
It was never exposed. You know, when was it exposed? I don't really know. It was, people in Laos always knew that there was something happening up there.
But I meant back to the American public and senators and things.
Was it ever exposed? I mean, even to the general public.
Mm. Oh yeah.
I don't really know when it was exposed. I mean, we knew that we were working on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but actually bombing Laos, I'm not sure at what point. It was always kind of secret, the bombing in Laos. It was never really open. We weren't in Laos. That's what we were told. So I'm not sure, you know, when it was really acknowledged that we were in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if it has been or not. And now I guess de facto we're looking for pilots there, so clearly there was a reason why those pilots were there.
Yeah.
But in those days you weren't looking for pilots. There were no pilots shot down. You know, it was a hidden war, and it was known by some people, but I guess it was known by more and more people over time. But
of
when
course.
Was it really known officially that we were dropping bombs in Laos?
Mm-hmm.
It was at one point it became more and more widely known.
No, I was only asking because I was wondering if these pilots were wanting to be extra secret, because by the time you had were making this trip, there were already revelations in Congress and already questions being asked, so they thought, oh my God, it's more heat, get out of here and give you the finger.
I think it was probably in 73, 2.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It would have been hot in Congress at that time.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah.
No, I've been away. I was away from the States for 6 years, so
that's right. Yeah,
it's hard
yeah.
for me to place how things were perceived in this country.
I can't remember what year the AID director admitted that his agency was being used as a cover for the CIA, but that made the national papers.
Okay, I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
you know, from Laos, you don't.
Yeah, but I forget the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So anyway, the war was, from our perspective, in Vientiane, there was no
mm-hmm,
war. There was a limit; you couldn't go beyond K-3, K-9, so you knew there was something beyond there. But as far as an active war, there wasn't.
The thing about K-9, that just seems like a bit of an overreaction on their part. I mean, yes, pull people out of forward areas, you know, where fighting is going on, but, you know, what's wrong with K-15?
Yeah.
That's probably perfectly fine.
I guess it was just, they didn't want to get any more heat.
Yeah.
Losing more Americans,
sure.
I guess, and this was just, as you said, an overreaction.
Yeah.
I don't think there was really anything in the anything happening in the plains, in Vientiane plains, which is a fairly extensive area. It takes 3 hours to get out of the plains.
Who were your IVS supervisors during your time, if you can remember?
Jim Melia was in
at the very beginning. Now I know that Bob Lovin was around when but he was in charge of the dwindling program for ag and community development, but I don't know who the education person.
It was Larry Woodson. Woodson?
Was
in education.
Okay.
And I don't know if you know him, he's still, I think in Kansas right now, and he's fairly active in making a Lao newsletter. Keeping everyone informed of who's where.
Uh-huh.
Fairly active in the newsletter.
He
has.
Larry Woodson.
Oh, and Mike Fields was also the education person.
Oh, okay.
Mike Fields. And David. There was a man who was on crutches towards the end. And then there were some problems with him. He had a gun also. And he had, I think, some psychological problems at the end. And it was not very clear with his wife. And
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So they were David Starrett.
How would you spell that?
S-T-A-Y. Well, that's really, you know, I haven't thought about his name for 20 years.
Uh-huh. Mike Starrett.
Okay, that was pretty close.
S-T-A-R-R-A-T-T.
Yeah, that's right, Mike Starrett.
Yeah, he's in San Jose.
Okay, yeah, he's the one who, I'm not sure what happened. He
was crippled?
Yeah.
Crippled or just hurt himself?
No, crippled.
Uh-huh.
And there were some personal family problems with guns and wives, and it was kind of strange. Yeah, towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
He was in education. There was Mike Fields. Mike Fields in between, who was well known for his basketball.
And, oh, really?
And coaching the basketball team in Dundalk.
Okay.
And bringing movies to Dundalk. Every so often we have movies shown at the Salle de Fête, the festivities hall, special open building for basketball and movies. And he would show American movies so often, which of course was a big draw.
Yeah.
And everyone would come from villagers in the area, and in addition to the students.
And then toward 75, who would have been, was that Jim Lynn?
Yeah, Jim Lynn, right. That's right, Jim Lynn.
Because I was meeting with Doug.
Gilzo.
Yeah, and he was right. He was talking about Lynn.
That's right, Jim Lynn at the end. And remember, we brought our bags of our boxes of belongings.
Uh-huh.
They were all being stored in his house on the assumption that they'd eventually leave and be shipped out, depending on what happened those last days in May. And it turned out that they were finally shipped out.
Yeah, I was amazed. Yeah.
It was a very... The evacuation was a very, very tame, especially if you were familiar with or had seen the Vietnam Saigon evacuation. This is nothing at all.
Or the Cambodian.
We saw things happening over the last couple of months. The Patalao were coming in. There's a lot more of this enthusiasm for the Patalao, anti-corruption, and this is our country, kind of really catchy songs. Uh-huh. If you know Up With People, a moral rearmament in the old days, 20 years ago in this country, Up With People is very much pro-people and really catchy songs. I mean, really got you loving your neighbor kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, the Patalao had really catchy songs also.
Uh-huh.
And just a few days before we were evacuated, before we were told, we saw the Patalao coming in with their tanks, their armored troop carriers, the back road. They were trying to avoid Vientiane because it was part of the agreement, but they didn't want to go through Vientiane apparently because of fear of getting people upset or shocking a few people. So they came through the back road, which is by Dundalk, to K-13 in that direction. So they avoided Vientiane. And
this is how many months before
this
you
was
left?
No, this was a couple of days.
Just a couple of days before you left.
And there was much more activity on the part of the students. The students were in control.
Mm-hmm.
They had closed off the gate to K-6, and K-6 was nice, but there was one gate in, one gate out, and of course if someone else manned the gate, then you couldn't get out. And so the students had manned that gate and had control over K-6, essentially. But anyway, the next Saturday we went to the morning market to go shopping and came back at noon, and we were told in 5 hours the plane was leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Two seats were reserved for us, and that was the embassy obligation to us. If you want to go, you can go, and if you didn't, then you're on your own. But you could stay, basically.
Uh-huh.
And so, as we mentioned the other day, we went because Heng didn't have American papers yet, and we felt and there was a problem in getting Lao papers to get out for Lao citizens, so felt that it was best to leave with the mob, with the group.
Yeah.
And so we left that afternoon at 5 o'clock on the Royal Air Lao flight. Special flight to Bangkok. It wasn't a military flight or anything, it was just a regular flight. With the stewardess at the end, on arrival in Bangkok, giving her usual spiel, hope you had an enjoyable time in Laos and hope to see you back soon, which raised a number of chuckles because a number of Americans had left under very bad circumstances. In town near the American mission, the Hadiao, it was pretty much under control of the students. The gates were closed and the Americans couldn't get in, except for the fortress that was manned by the Marines. But basically all the other buildings in the compound and all the American houses nearby were taken over by hooligan elements who would just come in and walk in and out. It was kind of a bad scene for a number of the Americans. This little statement at the end on our arrival in Bangkok hit people kind of strange. So it was, but it was generally a very peaceful exit, and some volunteers decided to stay longer.
Talked to that fellow, Paul Ayer. He mentioned how he, I'm going to have to listen to his tape, but he said he stayed on a couple of months.
And I mentioned Peter Reynolds, I think a Canadian. He may not have been IVS. He probably wasn't IVS. Maybe CUSO volunteer or something. Canadian volunteer. And he stayed a number of months and did research. And then, of course, the Peace Corps volunteer, Jerry Porter.
Yeah.
Who stayed there as long as he could.
Yeah, until they kicked him out finally.
I think he finally left. I don't think he was kicked out, but it was such a difficult situation that he felt essentially that they kicked him out.
I was thinking, you know, you don't have to exactly formally present someone with deportation papers to, in fact, kick them out by the way you treat them. But still, I mean, you know, that not many Vietnamese were doing that, and certainly no Khmer were doing that at all. If I can back up, I made a couple of notes to myself and got some mental things too. I might back up all the way to the training.
Yeah, if I remember anything in the training.
Well, you went to Harper's Ferry. How did they prepare you? Both there in Harper's Ferry, and then later when you were first arrived, before you actually went off to Dundalk.
There was very little preparation. That was unfortunate in a way. Our team was both ag people still, and education team. It must have been at the end of the summer, before school began.
Were you all Laos bound, or were there Vietnam people?
I can't remember.
Okay.
I can't remember that at all.
Sometimes they had mixed the group before.
It didn't appear to me to have been mixed, but I can't recall.
Okay. About how many of you?
Why? There were a dozen.
Okay. So a relatively small group.
Oh, yeah, it was a small group.
It wasn't like 30 or 40 or anything like that.
I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And it wasn't much orientation. It was a discussion of, there were some previous volunteers there, a discussion of some of their experiences, some of their jokes, Lao language jokes, which usually off-color jokes, because Lao is a very earthy language, number one, and there's a large number of words which are Lao words, but if you say it in English, they're innocent words in English, but they have sexual connotations in Lao, and that was, you know, it was the in-joke. There were so many of these words that lend themselves to jokes. I remember that. There was a lot of joking by the former volunteers who were there sharing their experiences. But there was, I can't remember very much of the training as such. It wasn't really much of a training. But I remember we spent some time swimming, and we spent some time eating, a lot of time eating at the Hilltop House. I can't remember very much.
Because the substance, even from the volunteers themselves, are dirty jokes.
Yeah. It was part of it. It wasn't only, though, but it was just...
But that certainly is the first thing that you mentioned.
It was in joke. That's something you remember, because there were, we talk about language, and there was no language training. As a matter of fact, that was one of the unfortunate things. I went a little later than the group. I went a week later because I guess I wasn't sure I was going, but then I ended up going, so I left after the group left. I think the group, at least part of the group, went to Erie, in the Philippines.
People would have.
But in any case, it was very brief, and then we ended up in Vientiane, and then I arrived in Vientiane just before school began, probably a week or so before school began, or a week or two. It was very close. And we were teaching in English, so why learn Lao, basically? And there was Camus there, a Lao teacher, who gave us, it was a couple of weeks before, who started teaching us Lao. But, it was not a very solid effort, because we weren't going to need the language, and there was not much time and everything else. So we picked it up a little bit, but then we didn't really learn. And it was pretty much on my own that I picked it up. We had to pick it up afterwards. I guess one reason was being impressed by one of the volunteers, John Murdoch, who actually also entered the monkhood there, who actually got a Lao newspaper, which seemed very shocking to me at first. He actually reads this stuff, the script, you know, he's really cool. So I gradually had several Lao dictionaries, learned the Lao script, and it's a very phonetic language, so that's very easy from one point of view, and was able to, between a book and a dictionary, read Lao over time. Uh-huh. So that was one way of learning that I just took to it. It was very tedious, but it permits me to this day to read Lao still and know the tones by reading the written language. And then I used to go to the morning market, and one reason I did go to the countryside was just to force myself in a situation where there were only Lao-speaking people on the bush, and it was just fun going there and just talking to them, gradually learning the language that way. Also talking with the little kids that were in our apartment complex there, one of the six apartment buildings, and speaking with the Lao kids, because the kids, you know, very forgiving.
Yeah, yeah, they're better than others.
As are the old ladies in the morning market too.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah. They're just happy. You're their amusement.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, the morning market's just another day at the shop.
That's right. So
But why did you do this? What attracted you to the desire to learn Lao when so many other people weren't?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I guess I wanted to mix with the quote the people, to be with them. That's why I just preferred felt much more at home with the Lao in the bush than with American meetings or American parties or anything else. It was just a personal thing. I'm not a social person necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'm not, and I just enjoy going out and learning a bit more of the country. You know, it's hard. You're right. And that a few people did learn Lao, and some learned it better than others. Mm-hmm. Some didn't learn it at all. Essentially, there are a number of them. And I'm not sure. I guess ever since the beginning, I really wanted to. Ever since the days of early MIT, where I actually thought about the special forces as being so cool, learning languages and doing things with your hands and practicing and roughing it, and I enjoyed that. And I guess this was an extension of learning a language and being with the people, or whatever. I enjoyed traveling in Laos. I didn't go out very much of the country in terms of trips beyond Laos. I spent my time in Laos. That was also just, I preferred that. And when you're in Laos, I don't like being in a country to this day, doing consultancies, where I don't speak a language. I find it very, you have translators or whatever, but I find it very restrictive.
Of course.
And so I already spoke French before because of my parents. I learned Spanish in school and German in school. I learned Marathi. And I would always attempt to try to learn the language wherever I was. Because of this kind of frustration when you can't talk to people. And I enjoyed, and that's why I stayed in Laos. I started picking up Laos well enough to communicate and felt at home just traveling in Laos.
Yeah.
I prefer doing it.
Yeah.
As opposed to going to Singapore or you know.
Then you would have had to learn Chinese.
Right. Unfortunately, I speak English there.
Yeah, but then you would have had to master a British accent.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, pretty indecipherable. Yeah. No, Chinese would be easier. I'm just going to assume, tell me if I'm wrong or right, that the desire not to live in the American compound on Kilometer 6, as well as getting together with Haney and the other fellow, Ronk, did you say?
Steve Bunk.
Okay. Yeah. For at least the one semester or 6 month period. Was for the similar reason of wanting to get to know the people and being away from the Americanisms?
I think it's more, it's both. I enjoy being with the people, the Lao, and just being in the bush.
Okay.
I'm more at home in the bush than in the city. And it was also a desire to keep away from the ugly American to the extent that they were ugly.
And
they weren't ugly necessarily, and the Lao often preferred Americans much more than the Russian counterparts.
Sure.
Who they found very cold and very... Uh-huh. The Americans were naive sometimes, but they were tended to be very nice.
Yeah, at least friendly.
Yeah, friendly, yeah. Yeah, right. And they were very naive, possibly, you know, they would give things or whatever. They just put their foot in it, but they were kind of clumsy, but they were nice. But I guess that was just a desire to keep
rich
away
country from bumpkins.
Plus, you know, the whole thing of the war and aid and CIA and the role of USAID,
mm-hmm.
I mean, supporting the war effort. I guess one felt that by staying away from aid a bit,
uh-huh.
you know, kept away from that. You know, although I did make use of the commissaries I mentioned. You know, very occasionally went to the movies, very rarely. We had the movies, of course, on campus with Mike Fields bringing the movies occasionally to campus.
So
that's good enough.
Yeah.
Let's see what, but generally, even to this day, when I go overseas, I just prefer going out in the bush.
Okay.
As opposed to meetings with government ministries and ministers and whatnot. Just,
okay. You also had something unique for most volunteers, and that is a knowledge of French.
Yeah.
You know, from your childhood days. Did you use that in Laos? And if so, what impact did that have, or what utility,
well,
or...?
I think I fairly quickly found Lao more useful than French. I must have used some French.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't really stand out in my mind. What stands out in my mind is going to Vietnam. For the only time I went to Vietnam was a year, within a year after I arrived in Laos, because I had, in those days you got an airplane ticket and it was by mileage. And
uh-huh.
if you got to Laos and you weren't up to the next tier, you had extra mileage at the end of your ticket, and
mm-hmm.
you could go to wherever you wanted as long as you, you know, finish up the mileage. So my trip went to Saigon, to Kuala Lumpur, Singapore. And by the time I got to Singapore, my mileage was expired.
Uh-huh.
So I was able to go to just before the year was up to,
mm-hmm.
to do that. And in Saigon, I didn't speak Vietnamese clearly. I
right.
figured I'd speak French because, you know.
See if you can do
yeah.
that. Yeah.
And no one spoke French to me.